This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Scott Simon, and we're broadcasting today from the House side of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. The new 110th Congress was sworn in just a half hour ago. Today marks a turning point in several ways. For the first time, as you heard, a woman is Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi of California. For the first time in 12 years, Democrats control both the House and Senate. This is also the most religiously diverse Congress in U.S. history. It includes the first Muslim member, the first two Buddhists, Jews, Baptists, Christian Scientists, Episcopalians, and Mormons, among others. This increased diversity of faith raises questions about the effect all these different beliefs may have on the new Congress. Now, when John F. Kennedy ran for president in 1960, he made a point of declaring his independence from his church. Now, many people who run for office make a point of declaring that they are people of faith. Many candidates of both parties now say that their political convictions begin with their faith. So, why wouldn't those values inform the way public policy is crafted? Why shouldn't they? In a minute, we're going to talk to two congresspeople about how their religion factors into their thinking and voting. And later, we'll talk to Deputy House Historian Fred Beitler about this beautiful room. We wish you could see it, but we'll tell you plenty about it that we're broadcasting from today, as well as some other facts about this building on this day. But first, faith on Capitol Hill. We want to hear from you. How much should the faith of those in public life influence their decisions? You can join the conversation. Our number in Washington, D.C. is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. We're going to be joined by a couple of congressmen. Eventually, we're told they're on the House floor, they're being sworn in, so obviously they've got the one more thing in their life that's more important than appearing on National Public Radio. But we do have a guest with us, William D'Antonio, who's a fellow at the Life Cycle Institute at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C. The Institute studies the interaction of religion and public policy. Mr. D'Antonio, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And does the separation of church and state, a phrase I believe that does not appear in the Constitution, mean a separation of religion and politics?
Well, it can't possibly mean that in a sense that the religion has no legal or logical input into politics. From the very beginning, from Washington through Jefferson down to the present president, religion has obviously had a place in politics. The question is what kind of a place and to what extent might religion drive the political machinery of our government? I think that's the question that we study.
And has this ebbed and flowed over the decades?
It has certainly ebbed and flowed over the decades. In 1972, for example, when President our deceased President Gerald Ford was in his last session as minority leader, only 34% of roll call votes in the House could be tallied on the basis of a political party loyalty. The rest were a variety of issues, region of the country, perhaps religious beliefs, a whole variety of other issues. But by 1996, 85% to 90% of all roll call votes in the House were controlled by party loyalty. And it seems to me that when I look closely at these issues, you see that party loyalty trumps religion in a direct sense. I could explain that if you wanted more.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I've looked, a colleague of mine at George Washington, Steve Tuck, and I've been looking at abortion as perhaps an exemplar of the polarization which seems to have hit our Congress over the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. And what we notice is that mainline Protestants whose theologies, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Congregational, and so on, all of their theologies permit a woman's right to abortion under a variety of circumstances. Well, mainline Protestants who are Democrats have increased their pro-choice vote from 1980 through 2003, the last year we looked at, from like 55 or 60% to 75-80%. At the same time, mainline Protestant Republicans, their pro-choice votes are down around zero. So it isn't whether you're a mainline Protestant, it's whether you're a mainline Protestant Democrat or Republican. You could put the Catholic Democrats and Catholic Republicans right over the main line. Protestants, you'd get the same line. Catholics, especially in the Democratic Party, have moved from less than 50% pro-choice to 67-70%. There are a significant third of Catholic Democrats in the House who do vote a pro-life bill all the time.
Yeah. Well, and of course, to use Lincoln's wonderful phrase, each invokes the same God when they cast votes on different sides of the issue.
Absolutely. Perhaps nothing better shows that than John Bonnier of Ohio, now the minority leader, who is a devout Catholic and who uses his family background as he talks about how faith has given him his insights into the abortion issue. He is totally opposed to abortion. On the other side, you have Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, who says that, again, her family, a Catholic family or a Catholic education, has given her insights and is the grounding on which she bases her political judgments when she ends up voting pro-choice, both of them using their conscience to explain their vote.
We might point out that the Democratic majority in the House might be substantially smaller if it weren't for Democrats who were elected who in fact are opposed to abortion.
That's correct.
Which was a change that was consciously made by some party leaders who felt that they ought to be more inclusive of that point of view, certainly if they hope to capture a majority of the members of the House of Representatives. Do you believe that this Congress, are you looking at this Congress in particular to learn some object lessons?
Well, we're looking at this Congress with great interest because we have reached a point of polarization, not only on abortion. Abortion is merely an exemplar, but we've been starting to look at how abortion may influence voting on other issues. And it certainly is clear that when party loyalty trumps religion, and then abortion and, say, same-sex marriage or homosexual behavior as a sin are key issues. They may carry a lot of other issues with them. And so we're looking to see to what extent, in fact, the Democrats may decide to reach across and really involve the Republicans in the legislative process. It's interesting that when Gerald Ford was the minority leader, John Bradamus was then one of the rising stars in the Democratic Party, and he gave a talk to social scientists at that time in which he argued that the role of the House was to debate controversial issues until they could reach an equitable compromise across party lines. And that certainly hasn't been happening in the last 14 years. In fact, it wasn't happening in the last years of Democratic control of the House.
You, by the way, don't get alarmed. That was just a door snapping shut behind us. you mentioned abortion as a signal issue. It does seem to me, anecdotally, there are also more members of the House of Representatives in the Senate who are now citing their religious convictions on issues like Darfur, like aid to the developing world, even raising the minimum wage.
Yes. In fact, if I look very closely and in depth at the both the House and the Senate and the two parties, it seems to me you can ground the basic ideologies of both parties in religious convictions. It's no coincidence that the Democrats, with most of the Jews in Congress in the Democratic Party, have a basis there for a strongly liberal position on the use of the government to aid the neediest. I mean, it's a deeply rooted Jewish tradition that to whom much is given, much is expected. And that also, it seems to me, is a grounding for the both the Catholic and the mainline Protestant churches. The mainline Protestant churches introduced what they call the social gospel teachings way back in 1912. Many of their members in Congress may have moved away from them, but also the same thing can be said of the Catholic social teachings, which go back to the late 19th century. If you look at issues like minimum wage, it isn't that, say, a Catholic Republican won't deny that might be important. It's just that they don't see government as the agent, whereas a Catholic Democrat will, in fact, say when there are no other agents, it's a moral duty of government to provide that kind of assistance to the neediest among them. So both parties are deeply, their ideologies are rooted in religious convictions.
We want to note, by the way, we invite you to join our conversation at 800-989-TALK. We also want to apologize for the fact that we're having some technical problems in getting the calls routed through our board to be able to hear them. So we are eager to hear your calls. Just give us a minute to try and work this out. We're talking with Professor William D'Antonio, who's a fellow at the Life Cycle Institute at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and they study the interaction of religion and public policy, and there is an all-time high of members of different faiths represented in the U.S. Congress. Professor D'Antonio, what issues are you going to be looking at that maybe haven't been on anybody's radar screen so far in this new Congress?
Well, I think most of the issues that are likely to come up and that therefore we're going to be interested in are certainly on the screen. Raising the minimum wage looks like it ought to be possible to reach across the lines and even get the president's support. There is the question about taxes and what will happen to taxes. And it's known that the Democrats do not want to allow the ending of certain taxes, state taxes and other taxes that just really principally help the wealthy. One that's not on the radar screen, that and certainly not right now, although you see the more progressive members of the Democratic Party, groups like Move On urging them, and one certainly is the deficit and the debt. I mean, I don't think most Americans are aware of who lends us the money to pay our bills and what they would think if they realized how much we owe to China, France, and Germany. So that's an issue that's sort of sub rosa. Are we prepared to really talk seriously about it? I would like to see abortion really open to serious dialogue rather than the kind of yes or no, you're for it or you're against it. Because the American people, every public survey that either Gallup or Pew or Zogby does shows that the majority of American people are sort of in the middle. They believe that abortion should be legal under at least some conditions. But the minorities on either side are controlling the way the vote occurs. And so,
Professor D'Antonio, we've got to take a break.
Surely.
Please stay with us. Broadcasting live from the U.S. Capitol on the opening of the new Congress. You're welcome to join us at 800-989-TALK or talk at NPR.org. I'm Scott Simon on the Capitol. Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Scott Simon. We're here today at the U.S. Capitol to mark the opening of the 110th Congress. Religion and politics play a role in many people's lives and often intersecting at controversial places. The new Congress is the most religiously diverse in history. We're talking about how that may or may not affect legislation. You're invited to join the discussion. We're asking our listeners to call in and tell us how this controversy may affect your lives and where they would draw the line. You can give us a call at 800-989-TALK. We want to mention we've just had some technical problems in actually getting the phone service up here at our remote headquarters here in the Capitol. So you might be better advised to send us an email for the moment, talk at npr.org. We're joined by William D'Antonio, who's a fellow at the Life Cycle Institute of Catholic University in Washington, D.C., which studies the interaction of religion and public policy. Professor D'Antonio, thanks so much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
And I was struck by a figure we see in some polling, that a substantial number of Americans, the highest number I saw was 38%, it's down in some other polls, are uncomfortable with the notion of a Mormon in high office. How do you explain something like that? Are these people who know just enough or think they know just enough about Mormonism to be misinformed, or what's the caution there?
Well, I would be surprised if any significant proportion of American adults know very much at all about Mormonism. And what they do know may be influenced by the headlines, say, of the last several months, where there have been highly headlined case of the Mormon bigamy out in the West. And so to the extent to which people's view of Mormons is that they practice bigamy, either subverting the law or even with the passive acceptance of leaders would cause many people to have concerns. But it's not surprising. I mean, if you go back and look at the polls on whether they would consider a black person as a candidate for the presidency, with the experience of having blacks like Jesse Jackson run for the presidency, we've seen a great change. That was followed by Colin Powell and now Barack Obama. It seems to me that what we need is the presence of candidates like Mitt Romney, who have a chance to talk to the public and show the public who they are and watch those figures change.
I believe we can take calls now. Let's go to Les in Huntington, West Virginia. Les, are you there? I'm going to press this again. Les in Huntington, West Virginia, can you hear us? You're on Talk of the Nation. Well, I beg your pardon. We're still having some technical difficulties. I believe, because we get a nice little explanation from the producer who spoke with Les, that he believes the country is built on faith and that faith needs to be a part of our politics. How would you address a statement like that, Professor?
Well, certainly our presidents have used the fact of religious faith as a way of creating a certain degree of stability and consensus in the society. If you say it's based on faith, exactly what does that mean? What does the word faith encompass? Does it mean a particular religious denomination? Does it mean that we should enjoy the fact that anybody can believe whatever he or she wants, including being an agnostic or a total or trying to be an atheist? That's part of the faith system that we enjoy in the United States, and which perhaps is a light to the world as we see other countries having great difficulty struggling with the idea that they can accept people of different faith in their midst and accept them as equals.
Professor, I hope you can explain this to us. We often think that faith has gotten involved in politics and even the deliberations of Congress in a way it wasn't, say, 25 or 30 years ago. At the same time, I've seen people go over the speeches of President Jimmy Carter, President George W. Bush, both professedly religious men, and find that they actually have made fewer references, direct references to God, and I believe virtually none to Jesus Christ, than, say, Abraham Lincoln made. And Abraham Lincoln was a deist, spent less time in church than both those gentlemen ever have.
Well, that's true. I mean, you go all the way back to Washington. You can even go back to Jefferson, who is supposed to be the classic deist in American political history. Yeah. But you find that Jefferson himself believed that religion could be a positive force in society. He certainly was not opposed to religion. He was fearful of the possibility that any single denomination might be privileged because the experience that he had of Europe's having privileged religious denominations in all the major countries of Europe made him aware of the dangerous ways in which religion in that situation could dominate the political scene, and also that religion itself could be compromised by such a close relationship.
Professor D'Antonio, I'm able to see on our screen here that there's a caller named Boyd in Milwaukee who wants to know, and I can pass on his question, would an atheist have a chance to win office?
Well, according to the polls, if you tell me that only a minority were willing to accept a Mormon now, an atheist is below a Mormon.
I don't think they even poll for that.
They do poll. Yes, they do.
They? Okay.
I believe that Zogby had that in his recent poll, Zogby or Pew, and they received I don't think they received 10% support. I mean, that just is not acceptable on the conscious screen of Americans, whether or not they actually know an atheist or would find an atheist totally opposed. The idea seems un-American to so many Americans that I doubt that any of our Congress members would openly say they were atheists.
How common is it, Professor, for a religious assembly to say to a member of Congress who happens to be a member of that assembly, This is a vote that's important to us. If you want to remain a member of this faith, you have to vote this way.
Well, it was the latter part of your phrase that caught me. The first part, we have all the major religious denominations have lobbying groups in Washington. The Catholic Church actually has lobbying groups in 34 of the states. The mainline Protestant churches, the Jewish groups, they all have lobbyists. They go to the Hill to lobby for legislation that they believe is important and reflects their beliefs. the second part of that phrase that would deny them membership if they did not vote in a certain way would be the point at which I think you're breaking through the line of separation between church and state. Certainly a religious group could do it. I mean, the Catholic bishops came pretty close when several of them said they would deny Kerry access to the communion rail if he appeared in their diocese. But that was pretty extreme. And one would hope that in retrospect they would consider that perhaps that was not a wise action. In mm-hmm. retrospect also, it's fair to say that more bishops supported or refused to support that position than took that position. But the ones that take the controversial position are the ones that get the headlines, even in NPR, I'm afraid. Oh, and I listened all the time.
There was a debate among the Society of Friends during the war in Vietnam about writing President Nixon an open letter saying, if you keep referring to yourself as a Quaker, please stop the war in Vietnam. If you're not going to stop the war, don't refer to yourself as a Quaker. And they decided not to send that letter because they felt it was important to not try and be the arbiter of somebody's faith.
Well, I think that's the strength of our democracy, that we have all these various groups, each with its share of some vision of truth and of the better, the good society. And while we encourage everyone to enter the public arena and debate mm-hmm. these issues, we recognize in the long run that some kind of consensus is needed that represents a compromise, and that in this mm-hmm. World we live in, that ought to be the best that we can hope for if we want to maintain a stable two-party democracy.
I want to pass along an email from R.M. Flanagan in Port Washington, New York, with a question to maybe amplify on something we've been talking about for the past couple of minutes. Mr. Flanagan says, in my high school, my Jesuit instructors taught unambiguously that the Catholic government would be required to impose Catholic doctrine on all citizens, even those who disagreed, because to, quote, error cannot be granted equal standing with the truth. Does your guest agree that they would have to vote that way?
That sounds like a pre-Vatican II statement by any Jesuit. Error had no rights back then, but one of the really 20th century pronouncements of the Church was the recognition of the freedom of religion of every person and the freedom to believe or not believe. And it seems to me that that statement reflects something that happened before 1962, and it would not be I can't imagine a Jesuit theologian making that statement and expecting it to be upheld today.
Okay. I'm just going to confer with our folks in the corner. We can take calls. We can take calls. We just have to signal them in a different way. We're talking with Professor William D'Antonio, a fellow at the Life Cycle Institute at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and the Institute studies the interaction of religion and public policy. I wonder, Professor, we have the first Muslim member of the House of Representatives in this Congress. We have two people who are Buddhists, one from Hawaii and one from Georgia. Does the diversity of faith in this Congress suggest something, once again, of the diversity of life in the United States?
It suggests several things. One, it suggests the continuing decline of the hegemony of the mainline Protestant denominations. Just 30, 40 years ago, they were a majority of members of both the House and the Senate in both parties, that is the mm-hmm. Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and so forth. They are now about one in five. It reflects a broader acceptance of candidates, and perhaps it also reflects that hegemony is less meaningful, that there is a broader understanding of party principles. In some ways, there may also be simply the fact that right now we have both parties with rather clear-cut ideologies, and the important thing is that a person reflect that broad spectrum of beliefs and legislative ideas that is held within each party, then that he or she is a Muslim or a Hindu or whatever, Catholic. You can be being a Catholic or being a Hindu doesn't necessarily tell you what the party practice is likely to be or the party vote.
There are more Jews than Episcopalians reportedly in this Congress. That's got to mean something in American history.
Well, that is an extraordinary turn. Whether or not it simply reflects the continuing a strongly progressive view of Jews that they have a responsibility to reach out to others. You know, they contravene the common belief that once you accumulate some wealth, you're going to become more and more conservative. Many of the Jewish members of the Senate, I'm not as sure about the House, are in fact quite wealthy, but they reflect the most liberal voting pattern in the House and Senate. Simply may be a reflection of the turn towards a more progressive perspective by Americans. They want to look ahead. They want to address issues like global warming. They want to address issues in environmental change, cutting back pollution and so forth. And they may not be finding them from some of the old mainline leaders and be looking, therefore, to new leaders. And again, be less concerned about whether the person is Jewish than about what that person is reflecting in his or her campaign for the Democratic or Republican Party. I must say, with regard to Jews, there's only two Jewish senators and one Jew in the Republican House. So for the most part, that reflects a rather progressive political ideology.
Let me get you to hold up just a moment, Professor. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're back with Professor William D'Antonio, fellow at the Life Cycle Institute at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. We have another letter, email rather, to read you, Professor. Catherine in Hartford, Connecticut asks, do we want to express this influence as religious organizations, or more ideally, do we want to look at how a politician conducts themselves, which reflects their faith and a life guided by ethics? Wouldn't that be refreshing?
Well, I think that is refreshing, and I'd like to believe that I see some examples of it. Perhaps it is a reason why Professor Barack Obama is receiving so much public
notice.
Did
you call him Professor Barack Obama?
Oh, that is...
Well, I'm sure he's got an honorary
degree.
He was a law professor.
He was a law professor. Yes, I meant Senator Barack Obama. That he seems to be consciously trying to reflect a clear-cut ethical position, but he's not hardly the only one, really. I think if you look closely, whether you're looking at Democrats or Republicans, a majority of them, I think, are highly ethical people. That doesn't mean that you're going to agree with their political means or ends or legislation, but it does reflect the fact that they take this job rather seriously. I think the public underestimates the challenge of that job in a political democracy like ours. You're going to go in, you're going to be in the minority or the majority, and you're going to have to learn to work, and you have to hope that the majority party is going to allow you to have some input. And certainly it was frustrating for the Democrats for the past 12 years, and it was frustrating for the Republicans for at least the previous 12 to 14 years after the Democratic Party became much more dominant and controlling and less likely to be listening to the Republicans. So it's not that they're not ethical. I think they are. I think that there's an underestimation of the difficulty of the job, the long hours, and perhaps earlier you mentioned, is there some hidden agenda? Well, one of those would be the business of financing campaigns. When you have to spend 2 or 3 days a week raising money for your next election, that may lead into the ethical areas, very gray areas that we just don't talk about as much as we should.
Professor, let me get you to stand by. We're going to
try
and take another call now from we're going to try and take a call. I guess we haven't had one today. From Boyd in Wisconsin. Boyd, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, and it's so good to hear you, too.
Okay.
We have about a minute to ask a question, Boyd. Then we have to take a break, and we can come back if we have to interrupt the answer. But please, tell us
your question. Actually, both of you answered my question before about an atheist taking public office. I guess just to continue on that, would one of the fears be if, let's say, someone of a different faith or an atheist did take power because maybe various elements of the Christian community, maybe the evangelical right, might think that it might be a threat to their own views, and maybe they would get some promotion from the state?
Professor D'Antonio?
Well, I'm sure that that's what causes so much fear, but I think, you know, I would say, what do they believe? What is their political agenda? What party are they running on? And what policies do they promote? Do they threaten my beliefs? In what way would they threaten them? I have difficulty seeing that.
Professor, we have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more on faith and politics. And later we'll talk to Congressman Mike Castle, we hope, about his proposal for even tougher ethics rules. I'm Scott Simon at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Civic Ventures, awarding the Purpose Prize to Americans over 60 who are inventing ways to solve tough problems. Nominations at leadwithexperience.org. From the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. And from NAPO, the National Association of Professional Organizers, providing home and business organizing solutions at napo.net. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The 110th Congress convenes for the first time, and health care may take center stage. New Democratic leaders have high hopes for bills on stem cell research and prescription drug prices for Medicare beneficiaries. I'm Scott Simon, Healthcare on the Hill, a special live broadcast from Capitol Hill, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Scott Simon, broadcasting today from the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., where the new Congress has just been sworn in. And more on the first day of the 110th coverage. Coverage will continue on our website, and you can also find analysis of the Hill's new leaders and the challenges they face on our website, npr.org. Tomorrow, by the way, on Talk of the Nation, it's Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here for a conversation with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the head of New York's Hayden Planetarium. Also, we'll look at the debate over eating meat from cloned cows. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation on how religion affects the policy movers and shakers on Capitol Hill, and we are taking your calls. What role should faith play? Our number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. William D'Antonio is still with us, a fellow at the Life Cycle Institute at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. Let's go now to a call from John in Portland. John
Hello?
In Portland. Yes. Are you there, John?
Yes.
Nice to
Hi.
Hear from you.
I'm sorry. Yes, my name is John. And I just, I guess I wanted to point out that usually the issue, as I think you just said, is kind of sort of framed as what is the effect of faith on a particular senator or representative's insight as a policymaker. And being a Jew, I just wanted to point out something that I don't think is really pointed out very often. That in Judaism, as far as my understanding goes, not a very meaningful question. The meaningful question is, what is the effect of law, i.e., religious law, on somebody's civil responsibility as a policymaker? And you pointed out there's kind of a lack of nuance in the public discussion about a lot of these issues, abortion included. And I just something that's never pointed out is that this question, these issues, this discussion has been going on for 3,000 years among the rabbis, and they've really produced a sort of a fascinating array of kind of nuanced positions on all of these things, which I think the general public isn't really aware of.
Well, I don't know as we have time for the 3,000-year history, but what couple of points would you like to make, John, that you think are particularly compelling?
Well, I just one thing that I thought was interesting that I was reading recently is that it is my understanding that it's kind of the position of it's a majority rabbi sort of opinion that abortion, while it's absolutely mandatory, as a therapy, it's not permitted as a for reasons of economic convenience, but it's not permitted on the basis that it's murder because it's not considered murder. It's prohibited on the basis of it. It's regarded as a form of self-injury. Which so though a person might be liable, it's their liability is for something like a voluntary self-injury, which of course is also not permitted. But I just thought it was interesting, and I just never hear the voice of the opinion of the sages is usually is not something that people I guess is not considered part of the religious discussion in America. But I always find it interesting.
Professor?
Yes. As a matter of fact, John has opened up the kind of issue that I think many of us would like to see, and that is abortion, if it were to be seriously discussed in our society, would have to encompass ideas that would bring in scientists, medical scientists, as well as theologians and philosophers, from whether or not one can use the word murder just because it's becoming used to describe what might happen to a newly fertilized egg. It is interesting that the just-retired cardinal who heads the Vatican, headed the Vatican version of our Supreme Court, said he would never use the word murder. The word abortion is appropriate to describe the procedure of abortion. He says fratricide is what when someone kills a child. Murder is when someone kills an adult, and abortion is what happens when a fetus is removed. That's quite distinctive from what's happening in our society. But I think what John was saying is if we're going to take seriously the notion of the Congress trying to reason through these difficult issues, then we have to have really open debates, discussions that recognize and respect the opinions of others being brought to the floor rather than simply driving through your own position without considering the other. And abortion is simply one of many issues then that would deserve that amount of attention. So health care would be another one that does. The public has a quite different approach to health care. All the polls I've seen suggest that the public is strongly in favor of much more health care for the 43 million currently uninsured Americans than they are likely to get unless we are willing to go through a year or two of serious debate and discussion and working towards a consensus.
Professor D'Antoni, you've been a real trooper to stay with us this afternoon and even kindly wind up by promoting what's going to be our next hour here on Talk of the Nation, perhaps unplanned, but thanks very much for being with us.
You're
William
welcome.
D'Antoni, the fellow at the Life Cycle Institute at Catholic University in Washington, D.C.